I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Professor Charles Watson, AM. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Michael.
Charles, I'm not going to hang around doing perfunctory introductions and talking about how beautiful it is in the west end of Fremantle, where you live, and how we're in this lovely 1907, just after the Gold Rush building that the Commonwealth built, the old Customs House. Instead, I'm going to hand you this rather weighty term called the rat brain. What is it?
Well, it's one of those things, accidents that happens in your career sometimes. In the 1970s, probably about 1978, George Paxinos from the psychology department at University of New South Wales came across and met me and said, Charles, have you got a photographer here because I need some help with some brain sections? And I said, no, but we don't have a photographer, but I have a macro photographic apparatus which works really well, and I'll show you, I'll take some pictures. So I took some pictures on 4x5 plates, which basically produced very, very high quality results. George was so impressed that he said, look, with pictures like this, we could make a rat brain atlas. No one's ever made a decent rat brain atlas.
Hang on, just pause.
Yeah.
A rat brain
atlas.
Atlas.
Yeah. Basically, a brain atlas consists of photographs of sections through the whole of the brain. So you start at the front and you cut thin sections, and then at the end you pick a percentage of them and you photograph them, and you get enlarged photographs, put tracing paper over them and draw all the things that you can. And it was pretty tough going because there were no decent atlases around at that time.
What was that time?
This is 1978.
And what were you doing in 1978 before he came over? And
I was teaching anatomy. I taught anatomy really since I graduated.
Where was that at the time?
I graduated medicine at Sydney in 67, and I taught anatomy pretty much all of the years after that. And I started soon after graduation, I started doing research on tracing pathways in animal brains. In fact, my first paper was to do with the corticospinal pathway in the quokka wallaby. At those days, we got quokkas from Rottnest Island.
But you're in Sydney.
No. First 2 years I was here in Perth, and then I went to Sydney after that.
I see. So you had the quokkas here.
I did.
And
I
lots
did.
Of rats over in Sydney.
I did. And so I went back to Sydney and continued on, really with an interest in comparative neuroanatomy. I was interested in marsupials and connections within the brain. And what changed things was that in about 1973, people developed a new way of tracing pathways where you could put a substance called horseradish peroxidase, it's a plant substance, into a part of the brain, and it traveled backwards along all the nerves that went to that point. So, for example, one of the things I did was I injected this stuff into individual facial muscles, and then went back and it showed you which motor neurons supplied which one of those muscles.
You mean we humans?
No.
In marsupials?
What did it in rats.
In rats. So poor old rats, they've got a bad reputation to start with.
Exactly. I mean, the thing was that the reason that rats were important was that at some time in the 70s, people realised that working on animals was questionable, and they pretty much decided that working on all the cuddly animals, the monkeys and cats and dogs and rabbits, was no longer a really good thing. But rats were still there, and they weren't so worried about rats. And so work on rats continued, whereas a lot of the rest of it stopped. So it was a major change.
So rats are fair game.
Yeah.
Now, I should mention to our listeners as well, jumping right forward, that you're an honorary member of the Australasian Society for Neuroscience since 2019. And this is, amongst other things, in recognition of all the neuroscience, rats, brains and the rest that you've done. Just remind us, because people are fascinated by neuroscience, why that field of research is important, and why mapping the rat brain became important?
It's a very good question, because the reason is that that all mammalian brains are pretty much the same. They have proportionally different parts. Like in humans, we have this huge cerebral cortex. But all of the bits of the brain that rats have, we have too. And so studying rats can tell you everything about all the other brains. There's no doubt about that. Some brains have special things which make them more interesting to look at, like some animals have fantastic olfactory systems or things of that kind. And humans, of course, have this fantastic cerebral cortex, and there's an enormous amount of interest in that alone, and there's no doubt about it. But the basic structure of the brains that we have is pretty much the same. In fact, when you go back through the vertebrates, all the basic things were developed a long, long while ago in the earliest vertebrates, the really most important parts.
So remind us, explain.
Yeah.
I don't understand. The vertebrae to the brain. What's happening there?
Well, first of all, we have to divide all animals into vertebrates and invertebrates.
Yes.
The invertebrates, the ones without spines, are the insects and all the other animals that are there. People for a long while ignored the fact that insects might have told us something about vertebrate brains. Turns out they do. There's a set of genes in the insect brain which specify their kind of brainstem and spinal cord bits, called the Hox genes. There are 13 of them, and we have the same Hox genes. We have multiple versions of each one, but these have been passed right up through all the vertebrates, through the fish and the frogs and the reptiles, and onto birds and onto mammals. The brains that we've inherited are based on a long and successful slow development of all of the parts of the brain. And the bits that work really well have been retained all of that time. Once something has enormous evolutionary advantage, no one can afford to be without it. And so we tend to have gotten all the good things that these animals developed.
And I guess that's where evolutionary biologists come into it, tracing what has happened with us. But just taking all of that, is there a sort of an Adam and Eve, whatever, invertebrate even, that starts this whole business?
Once again, a very good question. I mean, obviously the insects have actually got quite well-developed little brains in there, and they've got all the parts which the good bits which we've inherited. They've been passed on to us. Something much earlier than insects put all that together, and I don't really know much about the early invertebrate development, but obviously you have single cells that like amoebas and that sort of thing, and then multiple cell versions that eventually develop much more complicated things. But that's actually the biggest jump in evolutionary development, from virtually single cells up to a small but very effective brain that the insects have. And all the rest of brain development happened beyond that, into the fish and right up to us.
So when George popped in,
yeah,
and you went off and got all of the stuff and you started mapping it, was that a big leap in your career?
It didn't seem so at the time. It seems like a bit of a pain in the neck, because I had to work on this new project. I wasn't convinced that it was really going to go anywhere, but George was insistent, and so we worked for actually about 4 years on and off in George's office, with big photographs and tracing paper and drawing all the things that we could. What reminds me of is the fact that at one point in the 80s, when I was one of my many trips to Sydney, my granddaughter, who was about 5 or 6 at the time, accosted me. I was staying with them, and she said, "Charles, this work that you're doing with George, what exactly do you do?" And I said, "Well, we put these photographs down, and we have tracing paper, and we get 2B pencils, and we draw all the things, and then we try and label them." And she looked at me and she said, "Tracing paper, 2B pencils, Charles, that's all rubbish." She wasn't impressed. It wasn't technological enough. And that is an interesting point, because the reason that none of the other really smart neuroscientists bothered making a rat brain atlas was that it seemed so basic and primitive. They weren't prepared to go back to doing anything like that. But it turned out that the only way to make a decent atlas was exactly what we did. And although the first edition back in 1982 only labelled about 400 structures in the brain, We eventually improved it until the latest editions label 1,000 structures in the brain. And in fact, we've taken rat brain mapping about as far as it can be taken. I don't think there's much point in us doing an 8th edition. George thinks so, but I think we've gotten there.
On the early edition that we're looking at here with a purple print on the front, we're looking at a rat brain. Is everything in that rat brain the same, whether or not it's configured the same as what's in our brains?
They are, essentially. I mean, we're looking at this picture now of the rat brain, and at the back we can see this curly part, the cerebellum.
So it's top right.
And which has to do with coordination and movement. And the bits in the cerebellum are exactly the same in all the animals that have a cerebellum, basically. And anything else that we look at in here, you can tell what is a human equivalent. For example, with this little curly bit in the centre of the forebrain, which is the hippocampus. And all mammals have a hippocampus, which is organised in exactly the same way. And that's the memory system in the brain. So I could point to any one of these things, and the human brains and all the mammals, in fact, have exactly the same things.
Now, I imagine in all its 7 editions, the rat brain book has been used by students, but for deeper research. Tell us a little bit about how it has been.
Yeah, because it was the only really reliable and decent atlas, it was picked up by everyone. And I mean, most important papers that are published or books that are published might be cited up to 10,000 times. We're actually up to 120,000 citations. There's no publication in neuroscience which has been more cited than ours. And it's because it's the Google Atlas or Google Maps of the brain. And if you want to find anything in the brain or find out where to put an electrode or that sort of thing, this is the best starting point.
Where you put an electrode?
Yeah, if you want to, we're just looking here at this picture of the brain, and if you wanted to find out what the hippocampus does electrically, you put an electrode down to there. How do you know where to put the electrode? You go into this atlas and you find out how far back and how far to the side and how far down. So you've got 3 coordinates that you've got to have accurately. And then you get down in the end and you know exactly where it is according to the atlas that you're recording from. And you then find out what these particular cells do, what stimulates them electrically, what happens when you damage them, and so on.
So it leads, in that sense, to all sorts of applied outcomes.
It does. And it took quite a long while for people to realise just how important the hippocampus was, for example. But the turning point really was that in the 1950s, some surgeons in the United States did a drastic operation on a man who was having uncontrolled epileptic attacks. And what they did was they took out a lot of the inside of the temporal lobe of the brain, which happened to include the hippocampus. And the man's epileptic attacks stopped, but he never remembered anything after that time. He remembered everything from the past, but he couldn't form new memories because his hippocampus was taken out. His name is H.M., Henry Mollison. He's often usually just referred to as H.M., And he suffered from other things as well, but the loss of future memory, of ability to make future memories, was spectacular. And while people suspected there was something to do with memory in the hippocampus, they realise now that it is the place that forms memories. And it's divided up into different bits. One of the bits I've always been interested in for the last 10 years or so is that there's a big part of the hippocampus which relates to spatial memory.
What does that mean?
It means that can you remember when you go somewhere or other? Can you remember how to go there again? And the best way of telling you this is that the mammals which have the biggest enlargement of this part are the hoofed animals, the ungulates, the horses and cows and deer and all of those sort of animals. Many of these animals migrate long distances to find food during different seasons. But they'll migrate up to, some of them, up to 2,000 kilometres. Zebras, which I'd studied, migrate about 400 kilometres, for example. And they have to remember where to go next time. And they don't. This is not passed on genetically. This is the brilliant thing about it, is that the herd learns where to go. And the young animals who are only recently born go with the herd for a couple of years and they learn it as well. And what you find is when you look at this part of the hippocampus, it's massively enlarged. It's about five times bigger than you would expect if you were looking at a human or a rat brain or a monkey brain. It's absolutely massive, which I always thought was the amazing thing to me is that until I discovered this in about 2016, no one who'd ever looked at horse brains realised how amazing it was. And the reason is that people that look at horse brains don't look at human and rat and mouse brains. They didn't know what the average hippocampus was about. They thought, this is what this hippocampus is like. Well, that's it. And the opposite was true too, and that is that people who've worked on mouse and rat and human brains never looked at horse brains. It's been a bit of a problem that people have ignored the enormous diversity in brain structure amongst all the mammals, and they've ignored the opportunities to do that. This led me to another interesting thing about spatial memory, and that is that one night I was watching a David Attenborough documentary on African wild dogs, and there was a pack of about a dozen wild dogs that were chasing a wildebeest. And so they chased this poor animal all day until finally, sometime in the early evening, they brought it down and they all ate as much as they could. And they, of course, have to take the food home to their young. They vomit it up for their babies when they go back. But they had to remember exactly how to get back. And so all the carnivores, dogs and cats and that, have a pretty good hippocampus too. Nothing like the zebras and the like, but about half as good as that. And there are lots of stories about when animals get dropped outside of a city, they manage to make their way back to the front door after 3 or 4 days because they know exactly how to get back. They do have very good spatial memory. The other thing that I've only discovered recently is that there's a small part of the hippocampus which people never bothered about much. It's called CA2, and it's because it's sort of stuck in between these other big bits of the hippocampus, people didn't even bother to label it. We found it in the rat brain atlas because we used a stain, acetylcholinesterase, which beautifully stains this area. And so we knew where it was and what it was doing, but what was anatomically. But we didn't know what it was doing until about 10 years ago, some people working on mice discovered that this little bit of the hippocampus is the social memory centre. This is the bit that when animals remember who their family are and who are not family, in other words, who are outsiders. What they were able to do is they found that a certain number of genes were expressed in this bit. They knocked the genes out in mice, in a generation of mice, and the young mice, which normally at about 1 month realise who their family is and who the intruders are, completely ignored the intruders because they didn't know who they were. Didn't, they were normal in every other way.
Didn't know who mummy and daddy were.
No, exactly. Well, they knew that they were mummy and daddy, but they didn't realise they were family. That was the difference. And this does bring up another thing, and that is that the big revolution in neuroscience really started from the mid-1980s when Mario Capecchi in Utah discovered how to map gene expression in mouse brains. They're the only animal that you can really do this in because of the technology. But he learned how to find out what genes were expressed where, and also he could knock out specific genes and so see what an animal was like when it didn't have this particular gene. And this has slowly distributed its way through the whole of knowledge of neuroanatomy. And it's really changed an enormous amount. A lot of things that people assumed in the past, which were wrong about what belonged to what in what part of the brain, has been really changed.
Just listen to you, I'm reminded why people just love neuroscience.
Yeah.
You mentioned birds. We hop into people, humans,
yeah,
who seem to be lacking in awareness and saying they've got a bird brain. I mean, is that fair on birds?
Very unfair. Birds have an intrinsic difficulty, and that is that there's a power to weight ratio which determines whether you can fly or not. Birds can't have great big heads because they wouldn't be able to take off. But they've solved the problem in an interesting way. First of all, they have all the good bits of the brain, they have a hippocampus and all the other things, but they have smaller neurons, and their neurons are packed in, so they have four times as many neurons per cubic centimetre as mammals do. So although they only have little brains, they're very powerful brains, and they have lots of neurons in them. And we're only, I think, more recently discovering what incredible capacities they have. For example, this whole business of spatial memory, they solved in a quite different way.
Oh, well, that's what I was thinking. I'm thinking about the zebra that you've just been speaking about, this huge spatial memory in the hippocampus, and you've got this little bird brain, and yet we know they fly all the way across the globe and back.
They do, and they do it in a completely different way. First of all, they have magnetic particles in their beak. Many birds, so they can...
Sorry, magnetic.
Particle. They're basically like a little compass. So they know where north is. So that they can always fly generally in the right direction, wherever they need to go. But people have found that in their retina, they have a little, like a fence, like a sextant really, which casts a shadow on their retina. And the shadow is cast in exactly the right direction for their migration route. And so animals which have got to fly northeast simply set this, and as long as the sun's out, they can follow it. And if the sun's not out, they can still roughly go in the right direction and pick it up later on to do with it. So they have a completely different directional ability to what mammals have.
Charles, again, listening to you and asking you these questions, I'm sort of getting excited, but have you wondered or been amazed or come to the view that in fact we humans perhaps not as remarkable as we like to think we are, and that there are some mammals or other sentient things out there that are...
There's some pretty smart animals out there which manage very well in the environments in which they're stuck. The problem for humans is that we're a bit too smart. And, you know, I seriously wonder whether humans are going to make it to the end of this century. Climate change has been dismissed by Trump and other people like that, but frankly, it's closing in. And
What's closing in? What's happening? Why are we too smart for our own good? Possibly.
We've learned how to use fossil fuels, and so we've created the climate change monster ourselves, essentially. But we're not smart enough to stop using fossil fuels, and so it continues to get worse, and it's getting rapidly worse. And I wonder where we're going to be at in 2050. I don't think it's going to look very good. This is in terms of global food supply, what's happening to the weather, to massive storms. You know, the sort of storm that's going to hit Queensland soon is a product of climate change, and the recently big storms in other parts of the world have done the same thing. And of course you have the problem of fires like in Los Angeles. These are all things which didn't exist 100 years ago.
Changing tack ever so slightly, you're also the Emeritus Distinguished Professor of Health Sciences at Curtin University from 2017. And you have this other, as I see it, part to your amazing career in health sciences. You've worked with the WA Health Department in various positions. Tell us, A, what you did there, and B, how different was that in terms of a career path?
Well, when I got to the early 80s, I started doing some work in public health with a guy called Gary Egger, a very smart guy in Sydney, who was very interested in the possibility that you could use campaigns to modify people's risks, like in smoking and other areas. No one had ever really seriously looked at this.
You tell them how it's going to kill them and they might take notice.
But that's the interesting point. You have to tell them, you have to work out what you can tell them that will make a difference. And that's always, it's not quite that get putting the blunt thing before them. You've got to tell them other things that will help you do that. Anyway, Gary and I got involved in a community health program in New South Wales called Healthcraft. And although I was doing this work with George, I had no real confidence that it was going to go anywhere.
And, you didn't tell George then?
No, I didn't tell George then. When I got to the end of 1981, Gary came to me and he said, "Look, this fantastic position in health promotion has just been advertised in Western Australia, and I'd love to go there, but they want a doctor, and I'm not a medical doctor, and so you ought to apply for it." So I applied for it, and I got the position.
Lo and behold,
and so I ended up in Western Australia just as the Rathbone Atlas got published. And once again, things fell in my lap because the Burke government came in, and one of the first things they did was they slapped on a wholesale tobacco tax, which made them about $100 million a year. But to make the public feel happy, they said they were allocating $2 million a year to a health promotion campaign to deal with smoking and its risks. It sounded to Burke at the time like it's only a little bit, so it's all right. He didn't realise that it made it the best funded public health program in the entire world. No one else had ever had $2 million to run a serious campaign. And so we went ahead and did that. We ran Quit, and then we got involved in other areas, Eat Less Fat, the HIV AIDS campaign. I set up breast cancer screening. We had a very powerful team in health promotion, which didn't exist before. When I got here, there was a bunch of people, maybe about 15 people, and an annual budget of about $36,000 a year. So we went from that to $2 million a year. The number of people grew up to 85 in health promotion while I was there. And I eventually got appointed as chief health officer in Western Australia.
That must have slightly redirected you, but put you over the top of all of that promotion as well.
Well, I left health promotion behind. I was now in what's called disease control, but to do with mostly infectious disease, essentially. But I didn't get on with some of the senior people in the health department at that time. And I saw an interesting job at University of Wollongong as being Dean of Health Sciences. So I went back into universities. In 1994, I switched out of the health department, back into universities, and I worked first in Wollongong and then in Curtin, and running basically health science courses over that time. It was a good time. I really enjoyed that.
Just going back to the promotions, I can remember, I'm old enough to remember these things, back in the 80s, and yes. All of these big health campaigns, they seem to me to have been world leading. Other people weren't doing those
they
things.
They were. No one else was doing that. No one in Australia. And internationally, people were still stuck in the old model of what public health is about. And around the world, and in Australia too, they felt that public health basically was the job of doctors, and doctors should tell us what to do. Doctors know nothing about public communication. That's the problem. And it took a while, and that's why this guy Gary Egger was so important, to realise we've got to actually launch out in a completely different direction and learn about public communication and what messages are good, and we've got to test them beforehand. I mean, just like any big company that's running an advertising campaign, they don't just say, "Hey, let's just tell people that Coca-Cola is good for you." Let's work out what will attract people to all of this. So they do the background research.
So this is where the Peter Careys and the Philip Adamses have got a background in advertising. Must be quite useful.
Exactly. And lots of interesting people came to that. One of the people I remember very much was that there was a guy in Sydney who was a specialist at a television communication called John Bevans. And I don't know if you remember the lung like a sponge advertisement back in the 80s, which was, you know, that if you get a lung of a smoker and you wring it out.
It was a terrible thing. It made me feel ill.
But it certainly hit people. And he developed other advertising. The one that I really liked was that in New South Wales, they got a lot of money to run a drink driving campaign to cut down the amount of drunk driving. And he's such a clever guy. He didn't aim the television campaign at the general public. He realised that drink driving really depended on the police thinking they were important and doing something or other about it. So his what seemed to be a public campaign was actually aimed at the police. And the advertisements showed someone being pulled over and this nicely dressed policeman who was polite but firm, taken to the station, and this is what happens. This is what police do, you see. And so it was modelling for how police should behave to deal with people who have suspect amounts of alcohol in their blood. And it was incredibly, in fact, it was so successful that they stopped it. It was an incredibly successful campaign. But John Bevans was a very good example of someone from the communications world who did wonderful things for health communication.
Imagine all the money came out of the police budget once they realised they were that important.
Exactly. It helped.
Charles, when you look back, you're starting out a doctor, you get into medical science, you get into the brain mapping, you get over here and start running all these promotions, you finish up back in public, universities, health sciences. Did you enjoy the teaching side of that as well? I mean, you keep, in a sense, not changing direction, but flexing new muscles.
No, you're absolutely correct. Teaching is really at the heart of everything that I've done. When I was a medical student, I did an honours year in anatomy at Sydney University, and I started earning my living running anatomy tutorials. First of all, one-on-one, and then I started teaching at one of the colleges in Sydney University. And in fact, I was married at the end of fifth year medicine with 1 year to go, and in my last year of medicine, my only income source was running anatomy tutorials. I used to teach 16 hours a week. Somehow or other managed to finish medicine at the same time. And so it was natural that after doing my internship that I would apply for a job in anatomy, which I did in Western Australia. I really enjoy teaching from the point of view that it's satisfying and the people who receive it seem to enjoy it and it does the job. And so it's been at the core. And in fact, even now in retirement, I still do quite a lot of neuroscience teaching for a program called the International Brain Bee, teaching 16-year-olds about neuroscience.
Now that is something I wanted to ask you about. What's this Brain Bee stuff all about?
It's a silly name.
It's a great name. It makes me think, what is it?
It's in America, they have spelling bees, you see. And this guy back in about 2003 decided that they could have the same sort of thing for high school students called the Brain Bee, in which they would learn about neuroanatomy, neurophysiology and neurology. And it was a very good idea. He wasn't very good at managing the whole system to do with it, but it did spread. And we started Brain Bee programs in the states of Australia around about 2010, I think. And it's been going since then. So that in Australia, we have a competition in each of the states, and then we combine with the New Zealand winners to run a sort of Australia-New Zealand Brain Bee final. And the way it works is that the finalist from each country goes to an international competition called the International Brain Bee, which features about 40 countries. And who all compete for that. And the year before last, the winner of the international competition was the Western Australian winner, a wonderful guy called Sam Richards, did fantastically well.
So that ties in nicely, but I'm going to mention two words to you, Charles, and I want you to be calm, but tell me what it's all about. Gun control.
Yeah, back in the 90s, a friend of mine in Sydney became very concerned about the whole issue of guns. But the reason was that she started doing law, and she did a project halfway through the law domestic violence, and she found out in this that about 100 women around Australia were shot and die. She couldn't believe it. But so she formed a little group at that stage, which was called the Coalition for Gun Control. And she asked me to chair the committee. I wasn't especially an expert, but I had obviously experience in communication, public communication. And we worked away trying to convince the New South Wales government to do anything about it. It was completely useless. The Shooters Party had parliamentary members, they had a lot of money, they did whatever they liked, until Port Arthur. And on the weekend that Port Arthur happened, Rebecca phoned me and said, "This is our opportunity, we've got to go for it." And so we had a committee with six people, and we managed to do the job. I have to say that Rebecca Peters had another special advantage. Before she started doing law, she worked for the ABC, and she knew a lot about public communication and media and everything. So we hit the media in Sydney, and they were very supportive. And so for the whole of the week, we just dominated everything after Port Arthur. And once again, a lucky thing happened. Howard was only recently elected at that point, and he was looking for something which would make him look good publicly. And he seized on this and talked to Rebecca. And Rebecca, who'd done a huge amount of research in all of this, gave him everything that she had. He took it to the police minister's conference, which happened to be in Canberra in the next week. And they all agreed to support this national firearms agreement. And so we had a national program to get rid of as many guns as possible and to introduce legislation which restricted things about gun use. And it was first of all, it took a lot of guns out of the community, but also it started off a movement dedicated at informing people that guns were dangerous things. And 90% of people in Australia believe that there should be more control of guns than there actually was in the past. West Australia were the only state that have done this properly, and last year and this year they've introduced a whole amount of legislation which is the best gun control legislation in Australia, and it's doing well.
And you're an elected member of the Gun Control Australia organisation.
I'm on the board of Gun Control Australia.
Another long-term commitment. You take my breath away, Charles, but you've also been mixed up in producing the National Immunisation Handbook. I guess that grows out of all of your public health work, but we live in interesting times when it comes to immunisation.
Back in the early 90s, I forget who I was talking to in the Commonwealth, but they realised that there was a National Immunisation Handbook, but it was pretty flimsy, and it wasn't particularly well written, and it wasn't really even very comprehensive. And they said, "This we know much more now, and we should produce a comprehensive National Immunisation Handbook." And it happened at a time when I was thinking of moving back to Perth. I wasn't sure what to do, and so I took 6 months off from the University of Wollongong and worked solely on this National Immunisation Handbook. And everybody liked it, and it's developed into being a major authoritative publication. We're lucky, the New Zealanders have done some work, and we borrowed everything from them. We took some stuff from England, but we basically produced what was internationally, I think, the best handbook on what immunisation is about and how you should do it. So it was quite an important development.
As I said at the outset, Charles, here we are in the west end of Fremantle. Gorgeous place to talk about neuroscience and everything else that you've done. Are there things, if not one thing, that when you went through your career and then now look back on it, sort of makes you take your own breath away?
I think the fact that many of these key things that happened in my career happened completely out of the blue. I wasn't planning on these happening. And I think a lot of people imagine that because they started a career as an engineer or a lawyer or a teacher, that it will just be the same for the rest of their life. You've got to keep your eyes open. Stuff pops up which you would never have expected would happen. And for me, the Rat Brain Atlas, or meeting Gary Egger and getting into community health, and then suddenly money arriving when I got to Perth, these are all completely out of my control, but they landed in my lap and I was able to take advantage of them. I think that's very important.
And presumably, yes, if it's your grandchildren or anyone else, that's a real lesson in life.
I hope so. There's one other lesson, though, that I think is important, and that is fostering young people who are associated with you. I think mentoring, when you're in various areas of science, and neuroscience is a very good one, that is important. And it occurred to me very early on in the 70s that the most disadvantaged people amongst all of the people whom I was working with were women, and that the women were not getting into the best positions and so on and so on. And so I have focused on ensuring that the careers of women who work with me did well on account of that. And I can list about 20 or 30 examples of that who've done extremely well because of the advice that I gave them or the support that I gave them. Sometimes it's just a letter, you know, saying this is a really good person, you really ought to take them on and that sort of thing. But I'm proud of the fact that that's worked well.
Charles, we're drawing the interview to a close. And as I keep saying, you live just over the road here, in the west end of Fremantle. Became a first European destination for people who set up the Swan River Colony, the port.
Yeah.
Why do people love Fremantle? What do you find makes Fremantle the place it is for you?
Well, it was a question which my wife and I asked ourselves when we moved here about 20 years ago. We were living in Shenton Park, which we enjoyed, and then this apartment in the block just on number 1 Fillmore Street came up, and I went down and had a look. I thought, this is really good. I'd sold the house in Sydney and had some money to invest, and I thought we should do this. And when we got down there, she said, what happens if we don't like it? And I said, well, we can always move back to your place in Shenton Park and sell this and get out of it. And after 2 weeks, she said, why did it take us so long to get down here? And the answer is that it's a very interesting, friendly community. It has wonderful facilities. It was the centre of the sort of coffee culture in Western Australia, and lots of other things that have developed well out of here. And also, it happens to be right next to lovely beaches, all at the same time. And it's on the train. You're on the train, so it's hard to imagine. I can't imagine anywhere better for me to live. In Western Australia, it has all the things that I like.
Charles Watson, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Michael.